Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, is what I choose to call home, glistening like a jewel in the South Pacific, just far enough away from Fukushima that when you go outside and soak up the rays, it's beneficial for your tan lines, especially when you're wearing board shorts in the winter. My very special guest is the, I think now, leader of the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party, Julian Crawford. Did I get that fact right, Julian?
That's right, Vinny. Thanks for having me on the show. Yes, I took over as the leader of the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party just at the end of last year.
I've been involved heavily in the Cannabis Party. In fact, right now, within my view, is an Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party vote badge that was given to me during one of the election campaigns. I did all the video work for Michael Appleby and Kevin O'Connell, who were the president and, I think, Auckland Central candidate at the time. And one thing that, it's funny we should actually be interviewing you today, because two things. I was looking back at all my old videos, and one struck out was this video with Kevin O'Connell, where we go through politically, economically, socially, basically the whole spectrum upon the political spectrum of the effects of legalized cannabis policy. And it looks like, shoot, it's going to save the country. But very few people saw the video. It wasn't produced very well. It was earlier back in the day, shot at the daiquiri before it became even before that even became nice.
Yeah, oh, it's an amazing issue, the cannabis issue, and you know, a lot of people wonder why our political party is just a single policy party. But like you say, when you sit down and you look at all the positive impacts across society from legalizing cannabis, it impacts almost every government department. You know, we want to have people speaking out as our spokespeople on every government portfolio and saying this is a multi-issue party derived from this one plant.
So have you got an environment spokesperson and a climate change spokesperson, energy minister, etc.?
Yeah, we do have environment spokespeople, and you know, we're in the process of appointing some of our spokespeople at the moment, but as you'll be aware, industrial hemp is hugely beneficial to the environment. We're talking about hempcrete houses, which are, you know, extremely eco-friendly, well-insulated, warm, dry housing. Talking about hemp food, which is the most nutritional food you can get from any plant. And we're talking about biofuels from hemp, and you know, they say that there's at least 10,000 different uses for the hemp plant.
I heard up to 50,000.
Yeah, some people say 50,000. It's amazing what you can do with hemp. And
well, interesting, because let's take that as it were. Let's say there's roughly 50,000 uses, and that's just what's been discovered while it's illegal.
Yeah, well, a lot of that stuff was discovered before it got made illegal, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago. But imagine what we could achieve now with modern technology if we actually had our top researchers looking into hemp. There's plenty more uses that haven't been discovered. We're seeing hemp being used to develop plastics and polymers, and it's possible that in the future carbon fiber could be derived from hemp, because there's a lot of carbon locked up in the hemp plant that could be turned into these plastic composite materials.
It'll probably be taxed because it's carbon, it's terrible, it's dangerous.
Oh yeah, I mean, we're seeing all this talk about carbon, and I think it's exaggerated, the fact that carbon's going to destroy the planet. But hemp is the best thing we could be using to lock up this carbon. I mean, I don't think we should be polluting the planet unnecessarily.
Yeah, see, it's the precautionary principle. Even if hemp couldn't save the world, it could still really help, you know, like really help in pretty much every single facet of your daily life. I mean, I'm looking at these hemp cars, right? Car paneling. So it boggles the mind why I'm sitting in an office with a computer and a desk and a television and all and so forth. It could all, quite literally, my curtains, ceiling, pictures on the wall included, be made of 100% hemp, more or less, apart from cables, etc., hooking up the electronic equipment and the devices.
Yeah, I mean, we could be making all of our plastic products, all of our paper, all our clothing, you know, literally.
Wait a second, Julian, do you know what we currently make all of that stuff from now? Fossil fuels.
That's right. So chemicals, and that's the industry that has really led to the prohibition of hemp. You know, over 70 or 80 years ago, these vested interests have been coming in saying, we don't want hemp on the scene. Too much competition for the petrochemical industry.
Well, people have been talking about all sorts of competitors have been squeezing cannabis out of the market and trying to finance people to keep it illegal. I mean, I heard an allegation that Peter Dunne, the chief prohibitionist of New Zealand, was getting financed by tobacco companies, if I'm not mistaken. Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of that as a rumour. I don't have any solid facts to back it up, but it wouldn't surprise me if he was getting kickbacks from alcohol and tobacco, gambling. Who knows, you know, what these ministers are actually getting up to. Like I say, I don't have any solid evidence, but I've heard that rumour before.
Is it not an interesting tangent? Because when you think about the prohibition of cannabis, naturally, you must include, if you want to be responsible, the corruption of the people who are enforcing the prohibition of cannabis and renewing its policy.
Yeah, well, you have to be very careful when you're prohibiting a drug that you don't end up with the black market, with the criminal gangs actually colluding with the politicians. And I think there's many instances where the laws that the politicians have put in place for drugs have actually really benefited gangs. And
can you just define for the audience, what is the difference between a political party and a criminal gang?
Well, a political party has to have at least 500 members in it. But yeah, I guess a
other
gang,
than that.
Well, I mean, even political parties have sergeant at arms and, you know, similar positions to gangs, but I guess gangs are just more marginalised people who don't fit in anywhere in society. And I mean,
it seems that politicians are like career politicians. They don't fit in society anywhere. None of them have ever had a real job before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure some of these politicians are quite corrupt and end up sort of associating with people who are in the black market trade, but, you know, that's just rumour as well. I mean, they cover their tracks.
Anyway, back on topic. We were talking about the production of hempcrete homes, and we're talking about this sustainability, this green environmentalism kind of stuff. And I've been looking into it, and I wanted to know what the Legalized Cannabis Party's position was on the implementation of Agenda 21 to save the environment and kill off humanity. If you know anything about that at all, if not,
yeah, I do. I mean, we're absolutely opposed to Agenda 21, and I was quite shocked to see that our colleagues in the Green Party are embracing Agenda 21. I think it's a disastrous idea, particularly because it's coming on a global scale. So it's really undermining New Zealand's sovereignty if we have some sort of globalist government telling us what to do. I'd much rather see New Zealand have strong national sovereignty and the citizens having individual sovereignty.
Well, Agenda 21, I think one of the end goals is to eventually do away entirely with national sovereignty. It won't exist anymore. There won't be any countries.
Yes, obviously a globalist plan. And, you know, talking about the Green Party, this is a party that has pretended that it's the voice of the cannabis movement for years. It's been parading itself as pro-cannabis, even though it's only talking about decriminalisation. It's only a low priority. But at the same time, they are saying we should be implementing UN international law in New Zealand, and it's the UN who's actually behind cannabis prohibition. So it's quite contradictory to promote globalism at the same time as saying you're going to legalise cannabis, because cannabis would already be legal in New Zealand if it wasn't for the UN single convention on narcotics.
And is it not also kind of hypocritical to be trying to implement Agenda 21 globalism whilst at the same time opposing Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement globalism?
Yeah, I think it is quite contradictory. It's quite ironic, really, that these people on the left are kicking up a big stink about the TPP. I mean, I don't support the TPP either. But, you know, I don't support a global government either. You know, it seems to be a bit contradictory that you've got the likes of Kennedy Graham in the Green Party, who's worked at the United Nations University, and he's come back to New Zealand to work on the so-called global governance project. I'm not a big fan of that, because I think that once you have a global government, it could easily lead to tyranny on a mass scale.
An irresistible tyranny. Now, politics to me is like boxing. You've got to look out for the right jab and the left hook.
Yeah. You've got, you know, these two wings, but it's a bit of a false dichotomy if you get sucked into either one of the two extremes.
Yeah, that's why you've got to have your guard up, all right? And the analogy goes through to that, and when it comes to politicking, it is imperative when choosing the people you vote for to actually know a little bit about them and what they're pushing, where they come from, that kind of thing. So I wanted to know from you, Julian. I know kind of what you're pushing. I've seen many of your comments on Facebook. Basically, you think in most ways a lot like I do, reasonably and logically. And not afraid to speak out the truth. What produced this individual is what I'm curious about.
Yeah, well, I've been interested in politics since I was young, and I studied politics at university, and I've wanted to always just understand more about how the system as a whole is functioning, how the whole thing operates. And, you know, I used to be in the Green Party when I was younger. I think there's a saying, you know, you'll be a, you know, many people are a socialist by 20 and a capitalist by 30. And I sort of started out, you know, considering myself as a socialist greenie when I was younger, but I sort of rapidly became disillusioned with the Green Party when I saw that they were willing to compromise on their principles. And particularly with the GMO, the genetically modified organisms, We used to campaign against GMOs, but then when the pressure really went on in Parliament and, you know, the Greens were getting isolated, they, you know, quickly flip-flopped on that issue and, you know, made GE-free a low priority. And then the Greens did the same with the cannabis issue. They basically said this is our lowest priority now because we don't want to have all this publicity around dope and that. So I tried to find other parties that, you know, were more willing to stick to their principles. And then I became interested in libertarianism as well and was following the Ron Paul campaign a few years back when he was going for president. So I sort of moved more towards the right. And then I guess you could say I'm pretty much in the centre now because I like to get the best ideas from the left and the right wing.
Like a Gandhi Milton Friedman.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, capitalism has its opportunities for people to, you know, pick themselves up and use free enterprise to work their way up. But there's always going to be people at the bottom of the heap that we don't want to, you know, leave them just suffering. We need to have some sort of safety net as well.
Well, you know, I think the fact that everybody's taxed X amount of their income in one form or another to the point where I think, who was it? I think it was Will Ryan from Affordable Auckland said at one point that we're paying up to 60% in tax of one form or another on all of our income. And they don't do it all in one because I think the government and taxation officials know that if they were taxing 60% of your income straight away, you'd know you're a slave.
Yeah, it's crazy that, you know, there's so many fees out there that we're expected to pay to fund the government's activities, and the government's becoming bigger and bigger, you know, and costing more and more money to run. And it's not just that we're funding it with our tax, but that's actually a collateral against a huge loan. So all the people in New Zealand that are paying tax, that's just to pay the interest on a big debt that the government is borrowing. So it really is like being on a treadmill, and you know, the more tax you pay, you know, the more you're going to have to just keep working to keep paying it.
Well, it would be an interesting one. If the government could provide stuff for free, it should be something that the person getting the free stuff would have to meet halfway. Like, let's take hemp and New Zealand housing, for example. New Zealand houses are freaking cold, man. Like, they're cold. Okay, people in Calgary, Canada, and things like that, they think they know the cold. Okay, when you go inside, you've got things like insulation, central heating, double glazing. That keeps the cold out of your house. In New Zealand, the cold follows you in, and it doesn't leave. All right, that's kind of the difference. And now the government has been doing a large insulation campaign, a huge one. They've been chucking millions and millions and millions of dollars into it. Now, you can make good quality insulation from hemp, can't you? What if hemp was legal? What if anybody could go to the government and say, hey, look, I'm going to grow some hemp plants in my backyard in accordance with a government proposal that if you bring your hemp material to the government, we'll spin it into insulation for you. And you can get somebody to install it, you know. If we meet you halfway, everybody can grow a plant out of nothing, solve certain problems around their homes. No heating costs would increase, etc. You see benefits that reproduce themselves when you introduce a voluntaristic kind of meet you halfway response rather than I'm going to forcibly take something off of you and give you something back if you're lucky.
Yeah. I mean, hemp is actually legal in New Zealand. It's just that it's over-regulated. There's a huge amount of bureaucracy and red tape that you have to go through to grow hemp. On top of that, there's a $500 license fee. There's a $750 testing fee. So you're looking at least $1,000 or more just to get the paperwork done. And at the same time, there's no one really helping people or educating people of how to get the hemp license. When you say the government could meet people halfway, if there was some sort of subsidy scheme to help people get this stuff growing, and like you say, to actually have the machinery there to process it as well would be huge, because we've seen some hemp growers grow a whole lot of hemp and then not even be able to do anything with it because we haven't had the appropriate machinery in New Zealand. So there's plenty of opportunities for developing the hemp industry and bringing investment in to build up machinery. And if we could share the machines between the different hemp farms, we could easily be producing the home insulation here and also producing the hempcrete, the lightweight concrete from hemp. And that has really good insulation properties. We could be retrofitting houses with, you know, walls 1 or 2 foot thick, you know, really big thick walls that are going to boost the insulation capacity of our homes.
Yeah, it occurs to me that these kind of machines could be quite mobile, really. I mean, hemp could be grown all over the country, and you just have a series of truck and trailer kind of guys who just turn up on a farm. They're only needed once in a while, you know, during harvest time to shred everything into usable material, you know, that kind of thing. Should be right.
For sure. I mean, there's opportunity for that to happen, but yeah, we're not seeing any help from the government. Like you say, the government is just charging us money for all of these services. They're not actually promoting the things that are actually going to make the economy better. They're very cautious about hemp. They want to keep it under control.
Well, that would be the same underpinning of the wealthy in this country, because I found that if the wealthy people of New Zealand want to do something, it gets done, kind of thing. But if there's a stigma attached to it, a social stigma, like with cannabis, you know, people will say hemp, but other people just think cannabis anyway, because the brainwashing is that freaking deep. Oh, God. Just give me a second to reel from the brainwashing about cannabis and all these people who tell me that it's going to make me have sex with black women and murder people in my sleep. Sweet, sweet mother of mercy, the brainwashing is bad. But anyway, I'm sorry, I'm ranting. Go ahead.
But, interesting you mention rich people there, because Avatar director James Cameron, he actually grows hemp up in Wairarapa. So, you know, he's probably doing it quite successfully because he can obviously afford all the infrastructure. But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't have the money to set up all the stuff they need. And, you know, we could have a collaborative effort.
Bro, we should go check out Jim Cameron's crop, man. And you know, get him to endorse ALCP just so we can get a hemp. You know, somebody famous behind the movement, man. Invigorate.
It would be great, yeah. Any celebrities out there listening to the Vinnie Eastwood show, if you want to endorse the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party, that would be great, especially James Cameron. And, you know, obviously we've got the election campaign coming up, so if we could get some celebrity candidates, that would be huge.
I'm going to attempt to keep it, like, professional and whatnot, like, really reinvigorate and re-envision ALCP, because at the end of the day, the Greens, through their we're going to decriminalise cannabis policy, haven't done squat. And United Future blocks anybody who doesn't do nothing. You know, that's the problem. So you've got the Greens leeching the votes from ALCP. You've got a grandiose plant which can more or less change the entire direction of the country and make it a world leader in a number of industries, if not nearly every industry that currently exists on planet freaking Earth. And it's being blocked by people who currently control those industries of Earth.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that Peter Dunn has specifically made an agreement with the government for the last 12 years to make sure that no legislation is introduced to legalise cannabis for recreational use. And, you know, successive Labor and National governments have agreed to that agreement, while at the same time the pro-cannabis lobby has been completely neutralised by being, splitting their support off to the Greens. And, we've ended up with a very prohibitionist situation in New Zealand where there's been very little progress on the cannabis issue. But the good thing about the ALCP is that we have reinvigorated the party. We've got a bunch of new personnel running the executive. We've got a lot more enthusiasm in the party now, and unlike other groups, we're focusing not just on the drug, the cannabis drug for recreational use, but also on the medical benefits and the industrial hemp uses. So we've got a very broad approach to the cannabis issue.
Indeed. Julian Crawford from the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party is my guest. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We are sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn. You can check out the banner on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com homepage there. Also, Blue Shield, these little EMF protection devices. I got one of them, and when I unplug it, I get headaches for a week. There's something going on with the EMF frequencies, and this thing does something to it and stops it from happening to me. I found it very interesting when you take it away. Anyway, we'll be right back, and we'll see you in just a few moments at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere. Show. It's the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. My very special guest is Julian Crawford from the ALCP, that is the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party. And what's your website? Is that still alcp.org.nz?
Yep, that's right, alcp.org.nz.
I got it. Sativex is a extract of cannabis that is really good and has a lot of medical benefits. And it's grown by a massive pharmaceutical company with a special exception to grow really, really good weed under lights legally. And then they charge it out to people who are dying at $500 like a week.
Yeah, it's a really sad situation with Sativex, because obviously it's great that there is a company that's allowed to grow this, but the fact that they're given a monopoly and they're a pharmaceutical company and no one else is allowed to compete with them, and then they're trying to charge hundreds of dollars for each dose, it really means that only 4 New Zealanders are actually using Sativex at the moment. So that's the only medical marijuana product currently approved in New Zealand.
It's not true. There is also a clause where you can get cannabis from a medical doctor to smoke or whatever via prescription, and the doctor has to apply for the prescription for you to the government, and then the government has to approve the prescription. And since cannabis was made illegal, not a single prescription has been approved.
That's right. there is provision in the existing law to allow medical marijuana. The only thing holding it back is it needs ministerial approval. So if Tony Ryle or whoever is the Minister of Health at the time just signs off on it, medical marijuana could be legal straight away without even changing the law. And doctors are allowed to prescribe cannabis, but as long as the prescription can be obtained from a legal source. And at the moment, there's no legal suppliers of cannabis. Now, there's a license. You can actually apply to the Ministry of Health and say that you want to grow cannabis for medical purposes, but generally people are not being given permission to just grow cannabis. It comes back to the situation where they actually favour the pharmaceutical companies like Sativex. That allows the Minister Peter Dunn to say, look, we've got an option available for patients. We don't need them using the raw plant material. They can use the standardised dose of Sativex. But the reality that only four people are using it is, you know, he's using Sativex to block any further development of the medical marijuana industry.
It's a dog and pony show. Here, look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this.
So, yeah, I mean, we'd like to see some New Zealand-based producers of medical marijuana, and the Ministry of Health has said they don't want people smoking it, and they don't. They would like it to be in a standardised dose, but there's no reason why that can't be done with New Zealand-based suppliers. We've got the expertise here of people who know how to grow cannabis, but they're treated like criminals.
Well, that's because technically they are. And that's the problem. Does anybody notice the connection? This is something that Kevin O'Connell said in the election that I covered all those years ago. There's a connection between crime and criminalisation.
Well, if you sort of take a chunk of society and say you're a criminal and that you have to associate with criminals to buy that product, then, you know, when you go to buy your cannabis, you could be offered pee, you know, or you could be, you know, offered a place in a gang, or, you know, you're just going to rub shoulders with undesirable people because of the criminalisation of cannabis.
If something's criminalised, the people who are willing to get involved and take control are criminals. But in general, the people who want to be involved aren't criminals, like in the traditional sense of the word. They're not going out there violently haranguing people, you know, grievous bodily harm. That's not a stoner activity, you know. Stoner activity is consuming too much junk food or playing music and some really weird riffs or some stuff or you know. There's all sorts of peaceful and creative things that stoners do. And social things. Violence, criminality, not generally one of them, unless a criminal element is involved in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, your average stoner is not interested in breaking the law. I mean, they would be otherwise law-abiding, apart from the cannabis law. But when you have gangs getting involved in the selling and the production of cannabis, then there's a very good chance that they're going to do harm to society, you know, using standover tactics, stealing people's weed or, you know, what have you. There is definitely an organised crime element that is benefiting from cannabis prohibition being in place.
Who says the organised crime element and the people who make that element a crime ain't working together or have a mutually beneficial arrangement?
Well, that's quite possible. We've seen in New Zealand with the Whānau Ora funding that some gangs have been able to get funding for Whānau Ora, where they pretend to be reformed gang members and they want to start up a group against violence. And then they get funding from the government for their anti-violence group, and then they go and spend it on marijuana and sell it at the tinny shop. So there are instances of the taxpayer funding gangs to buy pounds.
Although technically that did make people less violent because they had weed.
Yeah, well, I mean, these gangs would probably be a lot worse if they weren't stoned all the time, you know.
Hey, you know, see, the, in fact, we had a discussion with, I think he might have been a senior detective, in fact. The cannabis was on the side of the road protesting on Queen Street. And we had a sign there that said, end the drug war. And the detective said, you should have a sign that says, end the drug war, wipe out the gangs.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to bring the cannabis market right out into the legitimate economy, so we are trying to take that away from the criminal gangs. Of course, it's up to those gangs whether they want to reform themselves into legitimate businesses and start playing by the rules, but we think it'd be safer for everyone if it was regulated in the public domain, out in the open. And, you know, you've talked about taxes earlier. If we could tax cannabis, then that would mean, you know, we could surely reduce tax in other areas.
Well, it seems like every single measurement the government has been taking during my lifetime of 29 years has been a band-aid solution to solve a problem that can't be solved by those means. Cannabis, on the other hand, seems to be something that can have longevity and solve in a very real way nearly every industrialized societal problem we have today, from any of the health problems that we have, from poisoning our environment to cleaning the environment itself up, and everything is rescinded from those two elements.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. Like, just looking at the medical benefits that could come from allowing cannabis, we know that people who have cancer are using cannabis to treat them, their condition. We know that people with epilepsy are having wonderful results from cannabis, where their seizures are stopping. And, you know, there's actually so many different illnesses and injuries that can be treated by medical marijuana that we really need to allow the science to take place. There needs to be more clinical studies, because with the law, they've only been able to study medical marijuana on rats. They haven't been able to do proper human trials, even though we know from the anecdotal evidence that it can cure or treat, you know, hundreds of different conditions.
And we also know from anecdotal evidence that if they were to do human trials, they would have no problem finding subjects.
That's true. There's plenty of volunteers who would, you know, test the effects of cannabis, and you know, they would be more than willing.
You know, I mean, look, if you ever want a science project that will have an unlimited supply of test subjects, unlimited supply, okay, you've got one right here. And talking about unlimited supply, thinking about the medical benefits, we're going through Rick Simpson, who I've had on the show a number of times. This is the thing about cannabis that he's discovered. In its purest form, in the high potency, pure THC hemp oil medical grade, you can cure pretty much anything. Whether it's cancer, lesions, a bad back, depression, liver failure, kidney anything.
It's amazing what Rick Simpson's been doing, and he's seems to have had a huge amount of success, and he's particularly become known for his claims about curing cancer. And I mean, some people you know, don't make those blanket statements about curing, because there's quite a few different types of cancer out there, but he really does seem to have the anecdotal evidence to show a lot of these people have recovered, even from terminal cancer. And it just shows you how medicinal the cannabis plant is, especially when you concentrate it all into the hash oil and just eat the hash oil like he's advising. And, you know, people like that, they're not going to sit around waiting for the science to confirm it. They know that it works, and they're just going to keep doing it. But, of course, he's been persecuted by the Canadian government. You know, he's had to spend time in Europe because of fear of arrest. It's really unfortunate that we're operating under these conditions where trying to save someone's life is actually a criminal offence.
in a world so full of madness, you know? That's the thing, we live an upside down world. In fact, have you ever played the opposite game, Julian, and you sat down and watched the news and played the opposite game? So every single thing that they say, you flip it round and it actually winds up being the truth.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes I sit down and watch the TV news and I can read between the lines of pretty much every news story that they're not telling the truth or the full truth. You know, there's an agenda out there and there's a dumbing down of the population through watching that sort of television news.
Apparently, Jeanette Saxby of the High Tea Cafe told me that the newspapers are written for the reading age of a 12-year-old. It's specifically for that, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a trained journalist myself. I used to work for the Truth newspaper, and you have to write every article using simple language that could basically be read by a 12-year-old. And, yeah, an interesting example, when I was a journalist, I wanted to write an article about bitcoins when they were worth $15 each. I wanted to write an investment column saying, good time to buy bitcoins, but because my editor thought that the reader wouldn't know what a bitcoin was, or the reader wasn't intelligent enough to understand that, it never got printed. So there is a sort of self-censorship in the media where people don't want to print anything that could be too complicated for the reader to understand.
Have you had a conversation with a really stupid person? You're telling them something that's very stupid, very simple, but quite profound, and they go blank? Is that what the editor's trying to avoid on a mass scale? So they're actually trying to curb their own conversation. Like, let's say you're talking to a person to person. This is the conversation of a newspaper to a reader. If you're trying to curb every single conversation you could ever have with anybody who wouldn't get what you were saying.
Yeah, well, they don't want to shock the reader. You can't expose that there's some sort of conspiracy going on to, you know, make their life, you know, a lot worse, and they like to think that everything's normal, everything's comfortable. You can't just shock them with what's really going on in the world, the fact that there's psychopaths who are in government, or, you know, whatever the reality may be. You know, we see a lot of warfare going on overseas, and, you know, we're not seeing the truth, are we, about the Ukraine crisis? You only have to watch RT News to see that there's a completely different narrative coming from the Russians as from the Western media. So it's good to get a range of sources before you make any conclusions.
Same way as making a Subway sandwich, it pays to have a number of different sources.
That's right.
The other element here, in terms of the international media and in terms the international sphere, is the recent legalization. Is it full legalization in Colorado and Washington State in the USA?
That's right. Especially in Colorado, they've got full legalization. So people are allowed to grow it at home. They're allowed to buy it at a dispensary. And, you know, they can get a medical prescription if they want, but or they can just do it for recreational reasons. And, yeah, I think in Washington State, people are allowed to grow it, but they can't actually buy it in the shops, so it's not quite full legalization there. But it seems to be booming in Denver. You know, there's just millions and millions of dollars coming in every week, if not every day, to these dispensaries. And the tax revenue is going to be over $100 million in the first year for the state of Colorado. So it's a huge economy, that's for sure.
Well, I think the statistics were quite stark. It was like on the very first day of legalization, the state made $1 million in tax revenue alone.
Yeah, there were queues of people coming out of down the street, you know, to buy cannabis on the first day. It was quite a historical moment for a lot of people to buy their first legal cannabis, and a lot of people had predicted that when it got legalized, there would be a huge amount of supply and that the price of cannabis would drop. But we saw the opposite happen. We saw that in Colorado, the price of weed doubled when they legalized it because there was so much demand and not enough supply.
Well, I think that's what happens, is because people didn't want to perhaps go see their regular dealer because it was the week that they could buy weed legally, you know, that kind of thing. And all of a sudden, all the suppliers that had access to legal weed had to go to all the previously illegal growers for it, maybe.
Yeah.
Who weren't willing to part with their weed for a small price. So here's the thing. If full legalization happens, it starts being good right away, but also you've got that kind of growing pain while the old illegal market gradually kind of loses its grip.
I'm sure that the legal market will increase its supply and that, you know, there'll be less reliance on the black market. But there's obviously going to be a transition period. And you know, with these $1 million a day of sales, that is only through about 20 or 30 existing dispensaries.
That's not $1 million in sales. That's $1 million just in tax revenue.
Yeah, but that's just from about 30 or 40 dispensaries. There's going to be a hell of a lot more dispensaries opening up soon. They're still really implementing the law. It's still early days. And they're hoping that in a few years, they're going to be able to make $1 billion a year off this industry.
As opposed to spending $1 billion a year for the DEA. Oh, wait, in fact, how much is the DEA? And here's another thing. Speaking of which, we're talking about America quite a bit here, considering we're New Zealanders and we're talking about cannabis law reform here in New Zealand. America's where all this stuff kind of came from. They've kind of proven to be the examples to look at.
That's right. I mean, the US has started cannabis prohibition. We've seen Nixon launching the war on drugs, and they've really exported the war on drugs around the world. They've pushed it into the United Nations framework and getting all the other countries in the world to ban cannabis, but then they turn around and start legalizing it in some of their own states. So that's why a lot of people are looking to the US, because if they can't maintain cannabis prohibition there, then the rest of the world shouldn't be obliged to.
How is the New Zealand political scene reacting to the legalization of cannabis in, say, Colorado? Has this been brought up in front of the media or made a big deal of? Because you would think that there'd be a huge hubbub about it, because whenever that kind of thing happens, that's actually huge news, and it does provide political pressure and ammunition upon the prohibitionists.
Yeah, I think that the media in particular in New Zealand is really picking up the cannabis issue. There's been a lot of attention recently about what's happening in Colorado and in California with the medical. And, you know, there's a lot of interest over here, but the politicians are still very reluctant. They still don't believe that the public is on side enough for them to just come out pro-cannabis. So I think more pressure still needs to be applied to the politicians over this. And, of course, the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party is the only party really dedicated to legalising it. So we think that, you know, the issue's not going to go away unless we get into Parliament.
Well, see, and even then, the issue will be stymied and stifled, and there's all these parliamentary rules and regulations. I think the system is broken, Julian. I think that even if a good apple gets in there, it only takes them a while to realise that they're part of a bad barrel. Like, you saw what happened to Nandor Tanjos with his valedictorian speech. He took out a ball-peen hammer out of his suit jacket and smashed his watch on his desk in front of Parliament after his speech was finished, because he was sick of the schedules and all the BS that he had to be put through, not to mention being surveilled by SIS, which, incidentally, the Queen has everybody who's a member of Parliament surveilled and checked out.
Yeah, you may well be right about it being, you know, a lost cause. Of course, you know.
There's no such thing as a lost cause, because any action you take has a reaction. I'm just worried more about, not only does the cannabis laws need reforming, but the methodology by which laws and elections are done in this country, and who finances the financiers and whatnot. Everything needs to be overhauled and redone. I mean, the system's broke. We should fix it.
Yeah, well, just yesterday I was talking to the Electoral Commission about election funding, and it's interesting that the main parties, Labor and National, get over $1 million of taxpayer funding just given to them, whereas the smaller parties are going to have about 20,000. So, you know, they're already at an advantage, these big parties. But our plan, if we could get into Parliament, our plan would be to try and hold the balance of power, which means that you sit in that centre ground between the left and the right wing where you can actually try and play them off against each other. And if we could be in a position where we could negotiate with Labor and National and say we'll form a coalition with whichever party embraces cannabis law reform, then we can really just try and just force the government to do it, not really expect them to do it through their own goodwill.
Well, you know, Julian, I can see you sitting there in Parliament gleefully rubbing your hands together as the National and Labor Party are fawning all over themselves and attacking each other just to get your hand in coalition marriage, you know, and you'll be sitting there just rubbing your hands together. Dance, puppets, dance!
Oh, it would be good, eh? I mean, we've seen Winston Peters do a similar thing back in 96, you know, when he took 6 weeks to negotiate between both sides of the house.
And, you know, Winston's got a lot of experience. He's been in there a long time.
But this is going to be a really interesting election, and I mean, there is every chance that John Key could retain in power, and, you know, it leaves us with the situation of, you know, are these people ever going to move on the cannabis issue? You know, we're going to be negotiating potentially with Tony Ryle, someone who hasn't shown much support so far. So hopefully the overseas evidence will start impacting on New Zealand.
Well, it's amazing in a digital age with information that can come at you in an instant that it still takes a government bureaucrat years to hear reason. Julian Crawford from the ALCP, Aotearoa Legalise Cannabis Party, is my guest. This episode is sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn, with the links on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Also, Blue Shields are back up for sale. And don't forget to go and see the Wagga Wagga Gourmet Soap Kitchen. God damn, that stuff is fantastic. You know, without it, I smell like a yak. It's terrible. Absolutely terrible. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you smell anywhere.
Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energies, cause none of them can stop all the thoughts. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it, but we've got to fulfill Jabu's.